Okay. So we're going to start with Talmud tonight, and what we're going to try to do is a half hour of Talmud and then a half hour of other areas, like we were doing the holidays. So we'll try to keep it a half hour and a half hour. Now, without giving any more introductions to Talmud, let me say this, that really, it is really impossible to give an introduction to Talmud, because Talmud is unique. There is nothing like it in any religion or in any science or anything. It's completely, it is a unique science. Now, I say science because I mean it is something which a person approaches with only his mind, just like with the same part of his mind that he approaches the study of nature or the study of geometry or the study of philosophy. It's a certain part of his mind, which is the intellect. That's what is used in Talmud. And Talmud is unique. As a matter of fact, the Talmud itself states that if someone tells you that there is among the nations, there is wisdom among the nations, that they're very wise, you should believe them. Because man is, intelligence is not restricted to people of Torah. There are people who are not of Torah, and they're also extremely intelligent. Science advances, and man is able to ponder to penetrate nature. But if someone tells you that there is Torah among the nations, in other words, that there is another religion that has a science like we have in Torah, don't believe them. Of course, no such thing exists. And Talmud is really the heart, the core of the religion of Judaism, of Torah. That's why Torah means, the word Torah means learning and instruction. That's the core. It has always been the core, and the Torah always revolved, the whole system always revolved around Torah scholars. All decisions throughout the ages have always been based upon the Torah scholars. They are at the center of the system. And until the Reform Movement, which was a few hundred years ago, I mean, the whole essence of Judaism, with the exception of certain sects, like in the time of the Second Temple Judaism, where you had the Sadducees and you had the Essenes, especially the Essenes were anti-intellectual. They weren't really intellectual, into the emotions. But I'm talking about the Torah that survived all the way to this day. There's only one system that has gone straight through all the way back to Moses, and that is the system of Talmud and Torah, which is learning, which is basically an intellectual system. And Torah, learning, is really the center of Judaism. The Torah does not believe that man should be involved in anything other than knowledge as the essence of his life. And I spoke at the conference, I spoke about the people who are moved by the eschatology, the end of times, and the apocalypse. We are moved by that. We believe, as a matter of fact, that Adam was placed in the Garden of Eden. There was no, at that time, there was no Isaiah 11 and Isaiah 2 and the other parts of the prophets that deal with the Zechariah 14, that deal with all this apocalyptic phenomena, didn't exist. But Adam was, we believe God placed Adam in the best situation, and he was able to do one thing, to think, contemplate. Torah was given to him as well with regard to that one commandment, and you'd be surprised if you really study the commandments how much Torah is involved in it. The rabbis tell us that he actually received 7 commandments, and we will see. That would mean he received an awful lot of Torah. So Torah is really the center of everything, because it's really not just the center in terms of creating a law which people follow. It's really philosophically the center as well, because the perfection in Torah is, as I've mentioned before, to channel one's energies to this area of thinking, not just to abstain. To abstain is just self-control. Torah doesn't really believe that that's an end goal. The end goal is to channel it to a higher kind of activity, and that is Torah, that is learning. Now, where in the Torah do you find this concept of study Torah? So I mentioned many times you have in Psalms, you have several places which indicate clearly that King David was well aware of this experience, the beauty of the ideas of Torah. But we have to go back to the five books of Moses. Where in the five books is really the source of studying Torah? Okay? Does anybody want to take a shot at that?
No, I think we're going to go on.
Go on, okay.
Let you talk.
All right. The place is the essential place which the Torah scholars have singled out is in Deuteronomy 6:6, okay, where it says, "And these words should be, which I command you, shall be upon your heart." Now, these words refer to the entire Torah. Some people wanted to say, Ibn Ezra says, some people wanted to say it refers to the Ten Commandments, which were above. But that's not true. It refers to the entire Torah, and you'll see from the next verse that that has to be so. How does it refer to the entire Torah? Very simply, because in the beginning of Deuteronomy, it says that Moses explained the entire Torah. That Moses began to explain the entire Torah, this entire Torah. It's in Deuteronomy 1:5. So when he says these words, he means the entire Torah. Of course, he had the last 5 weeks of his life he spent explaining all the Torah that the children of Israel did not understand, or certain questions they may have had, and reviewed it with them, and he discussed it elaborately. And he said, these words should be upon your heart. And then the next verse is important, because he says, you should teach them to your sons, and you shall speak in them when you're sitting in your house, when you're going on the road, when you're going to sleep, and when you get up. So obviously it means a total preoccupation with the ideas of Torah. And that's really the ultimate state. The ultimate state is the total. Torah is something which can preoccupy a person constantly, because the beauty of the structure, understanding the law, is an intricate thing, and it's captivating. It captivates the mind to try to resolve the problems and try to understand them, to ponder it. And here you have again Joshua, of course. Joshua is a takeoff from this, because in Joshua you have Joshua 1:7, where God speaks to Joshua, and he says that be strong and courageous, and observe to do all of the Torah which Moses my servant commanded thee. Turn not from it right to the right hand nor to the left, so you may prosper wherever you go. And then in verse 8 he says, this book of the Torah shall not depart out of your mouth, but you shall meditate. You got to be careful. The word ponder would be a better word, because the word in Hebrew means to think deeply into it. You should ponder upon it day and night. So again, you see the concept that he was speaking about something that is not just a matter of reading the Bible. It's a matter of being able to ponder this day and night, which means something which is capable of really deep thought. And again, in Psalms, in the first Psalms, it states that when he speaks about the righteous man, he says in the same word, he says that in his Torah he ponders day and night. So it's a total preoccupation. It's a very deep thinking type of subject. It's not just reading facts. You're reading facts, you can't ponder day and night. You just read them and that's it. So it is clear that the subject of studying Torah and the idea that we have of Torah, which is a deep science, is not an idea that is a recent one. It's an idea that goes all the way back to the five books of Moses and through the prophets as well. Okay. I will just give one, not an introduction, but a recommendation. Because the subject that we're about to enter upon, which is, as I said, the basis of the whole system of Judaism, it's the core, is a subject which is, as I said before, unique and different. And because it's unique and different, you really have to listen to it carefully before it will earn a place in your mind. You see, any introduction you're going to read, the introductions that are around about Torah are really basically a waste of time, because of the fact that most of them were written by people who really weren't Torah scholars. It's a strange thing, but Torah scholars never wrote introductions. And The ones who write the introductions are historians, and they don't know, they've never learned the method of analysis of Torah. So it's really just about, I haven't seen any good one, that if it appeals to you, it probably is wrong. Because if it appeals to you, it means that it appeals to you because the person is trying to associate with something else in your mind. And you can't, because it really is unique. So it's something which you have to learn, and has to find its own place in your mind, because there simply is nothing like it. It's unique. I would say there's one verse that comes to my mind in thinking about Torah, and that is Proverbs 22:17, where King Solomon states that he says that you should incline your ear to to hear the words of the wise. That's 22, let me just get here, 22:17, okay? Yes, incline thy ear and hear the words of the wise, and apply thy heart to my knowledge. What he means over here is that when a person has to know before he enters the subject what the nature of the subject is. I mean, if you're going to sit down and read a newspaper, so you're not going to incline your ear. You know that this is something which is rather plain and simple, and that's it. But before studying Torah, you have to have a certain mindset, and you have to realize that it's something new, and you have to give it time. I would say that if we continue to study, a year from now, you'll be in a better position to have an understanding of what Torah is, because you have to experience it in order to know. So you have to incline your ear. It means that you have to sort of abandon your own type of judgment at the time. You have to abandon your judgment and just listen. And after a while, you'll start to see what the beauty of the of Talmud is. That attitude, I think, is extremely important. People want to make judgments right away about things because they assume that they know everything. There's nothing new. So when they hear something right away, they're trying to put it into some kind of category in their mind. And they try to do the same thing with Talmud, but it's an impossibility because, as I said, there is nothing like it, really. And you have to just listen to it and let it just revolve around in your mind for a few days, weeks, and months until you'll start to get a grasp of what it really is like. Talmud is everything to us because Talmud, first of all, determines what we do. Talmud determines where we place our energies, and there's something more about Talmud. Talmud also teaches a person how to think intelligently in every subject, not just in Torah, but it teaches a person that develops the mind, and it's really God's course in logics, in epistemology, in way of thinking. As a matter of fact, if you look again back at Joshua 1:7, he says that... He states 1:7 and 1:8. He states that let's take 1:8, the end of 1:8. He says that you should ponder Torah, and then he says, so you may observe to do according to all that is written in it, which means the first benefit out of studying Torah is you know what to do, and then the second thing he says, for then thou shalt make thy way prosperous. You'll be successful. And he says, and then thou shalt have good success. This is a mistake. These translations, you cannot rely on these translations. What it says is as follows. It says, because then you will be successful in all your ways, and then you will be wise. That is the translation. This is terrible. They just omitted the whole thing. They repeat it twice. Then shalt thou be prosperous, and then thou shalt have good success. No, good success and prosperous is the exact same thing. That's that first verse. But then the last two words in the verse is, v'oz taskil, that's seichel. It means, then you'll be intelligent. So you see that God tells Joshua that Torah has two purposes. One purpose is to know what to do. God wants you to know the law. The only way you can know is by studying it. But the second purpose is to make you successful and wise, because the Torah believes that success is based upon how a person acts. If a person acts intelligently, then they're successful. If a person goes into business and acts intelligently, they're successful. If they act stupidly, they're going to be failures. So the Torah teaches a person to be wise and intelligent, and then they can be successful, and then they will be wise, because aside from success, there is wisdom also. Success really is intelligence on a practical level. Wisdom is intelligence on an abstract level. So God told Joshua that there's three things that will result from you constantly being involved, being involved on a daily basis, as far as you can, at all times in Torah. Three things. One is you'll know the law. Two is you'll be successful on a practical level, because Torah deals with the emotions of a person and teaches them how to work with them intelligently. And third, you will be very, very wise, very intelligent, because Torah really develops the mind. So I can't give you a better introduction than what you have in Joshua. And I would say that, you know, that it is important to abandon your prejudgment about the subject. Just listen first, and then you'll be able to appreciate it as time goes on. So let's start now with the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, okay? And I assume you all have it. It should be at the bottom of 55B, all right? Okay, now the Mishnah states that he who blasphemes. Now, this is one of the seven of the Noahide laws, and that is the prohibition against. And we say it in Hebrew. we don't say curse God, because say euphemistically we say bless God, because we don't want to. Usually, we don't want to. Say that idea because of the fact that it is an evil thing. So we disguise it. And we're going to have to use a few disguises in this Mishnah, because there are certain things not permitted to say. When we're discussing these laws of what is a curse, then we have to be careful. We shouldn't enunciate it, because we're not, you know, one is not permitted to enunciate that curse. And I'm going to get, I'll tell you exactly how it's done as we go on. It's done the same way as it's done in a court of law. Because this is the one case in halacha, the only case, where you have a problem enunciating the situation. Because in enunciating the situation, you're liable to enunciate that curse. And that's strictly prohibited, serious prohibition. All right? So we'll get to that in a moment. That's not what I want to get to at this point. But let's just start the Mishnah. Okay? Now, the Mishnah states that he who blasphemes is not culpable until he enunciates the name. I don't have your translation, but it should be something pretty close to that. Okay. Now, what does it mean until he enunciates the name? Well, let me give you the format first. Okay. So you'll have something to be able to keep in your mind to associate with. The formula for the curse. I'm not going to use God's name. I'm going to use the name Josie. Okay, and that's the name used in the Mishnah. And I'll tell you later why Josie was chosen. But the formula is Josie, and we're using Josie to refer to the name of God, as I said. The formula is like this. If a person says, Josie shall destroy Josie. Okay, now you understand what I mean. All right? So that is the formula. A person enunciates that, but he doesn't use Joseph, but he uses God's name, then he is culpable. Then he has committed the cardinal sin of blasphemy. Okay, that's the formula. We will get to why the formula is that way. Nothing in Talmud, everything is analyzed, but I just want you to have that formula in mind so you'll know what I'm talking about. All right, that is the form of the curse. Okay. Now, over here, we said the Mishnah states the first rule about it. And it states that he who blasphemes is not culpable unless he enunciates the name, which means God's name. Now, the name we're referring to over here, according to, I'm going to take the major view, is the four-letter name of God. And that's the one that's the ineffable name. Okay, and the one that the Christian world uses the word Jehovah, which is wrong because there's no J in Hebrew. That's why I can pronounce that. That's why that word is not ineffable. But if you use the Y, that would be ineffable. Okay. So he uses that name of God, and he uses it in that form, that Josie shall destroy Josie, or Josie shall curse Josie. Okay. Now, the Mishnah states that the only time you're culpable is if you actually enunciate the name. All right? What else would I think? I mean, how else can you do it? It's pretty obvious. Here's what I want to show you. When you look at a Mishnah, when a person just reads a Mishnah, doesn't have any methodology, the Mishnah just doesn't make any sense. But when you look deeply into each phrase, you'll see that there are ideas underlying the surface of these statements. Now, the statement is that you're not culpable until you enunciate the name. Well, of course. Why do you have to say that? So Rashi explains. He says, let's say, for instance, he heard the name from someone else, and then he proceeded to use that name. He proceeded to curse that name. Then Rashi says he would not be culpable. Okay? So if someone else said the name of God, the ineffable name, and he and then this person went along and said, well, that, what he said, that name should destroy, and he'll say the name, and he'll say the name, or the person will enunciate the name, will say that name again, then it would not be, he would not be considered a blasphemer. Okay? So the question is, why not? Basically, we know what he's doing. I mean, he's doing the same exact thing. So why is it that in that case it would not be blasphemy, when we know just because the other person mentioned the name for him shouldn't really exonerate him? Okay? Yet the Mishnah states that we know this is the law, that the person must enunciate the name himself. All right? That's the question we have to deal with. So we're trying to understand this phrase in the Mishnah. This is the law that Moses received. That the only way the blasphemer is obligated, is culpable, is if he actually made the enunciation. If his friend made the enunciation, then, and he, even though he used his friend's enunciation to indicate a curse, he still is not culpable. He is not a very righteous person, but he is not culpable. And we want to, when we study Talmud, we want to know what exactly, when God gave a law, he didn't just give a law and say a vague law. Everything God gave is precise and formulated. There's a formula to it. All right, and there are ideas behind the formula. All right, so let's take this first point in the Mishnah, and let's try to get down to the underlying idea. Now, many times in Talmud, in order to get down to the underlying idea, you have to know other areas of Talmud, of Talmudic thought and Talmudic laws, because it's like King David says in Psalms 19, that God's laws are just together. It means they fit together. They're consistent. They fit in like a jigsaw puzzle. They fit into... each part fits into another part. So over here, what it means is that we have another law. There's laws like this, that a person, when a person gets up in the morning and he wants to study Torah. So we have a rabbinical law that he's not supposed to study Torah until he makes a blessing first, to indicate the importance of Torah. Which means that a Torah, we know, is the greatest preoccupation. But a person is not permitted to look at it just like any other preoccupation. He studies Torah because he's supposed to realize that this is the great gift that God gave man. He has to have that appreciation. If he doesn't have that appreciation, even though he studies, there's something seriously lacking in his mental framework. So that's why before a person studies Torah, he's obligated to recite a blessing. And the blessing is that God gave the Torah. Okay. Now, let us say a person gets up in the morning, and before he gets out of bed, he's thinking in Torah. He happens to get up in the morning, and he's, you know, a lot of times I go to sleep at night, I'm thinking of a problem, I wasn't able to resolve it. I have to give a class in the morning, and I get up, the first thing my mind is that problem, comes back there, let me think about it. So the question is, am I permitted to think about this idea of Torah before I make the blessing? Or must I get up and then have to wash my hands, make the blessing, and then I'm permitted to think about Torah? Now, if I'm talking, there is no question about it. I must get up, wash my hands, make the blessing, and then I can talk in Torah all day long, because the blessing goes on the entire day of Torah. The reason is, as we said before, because Torah is supposed to be an involvement, like it says in Deuteronomy 6:6, day and night, constant, on a constant preoccupation. So therefore, when you make the blessing in the morning, it goes for the whole day's preoccupation. The Tosafists have an interesting expression. They used to work, the proper way really for a Talmudic scholar to live is not to spend the whole day in work. They tried to work like a maximum of 3 hours a day and to and spend the rest of the day in Torah. So the Tosafists, they are the, whenever we say the Rishonim, Rishonim are the major commentaries. They're, I hate to use the term medieval because we don't really have, in Judaism, that was the most productive period in Torah, extremely productive period in Torah. So it wasn't really dark ages. It was actually, you know, a time of great learning and great prosperity in terms of the knowledge. So so the Tosafists say that we go a half a day without learning. Like a person would say, well, we go without eating. Because learning is supposed to be something which is constantly a part of a person's life. So at any rate, getting back to the main law, if a person gets up in the morning and he opens his eyes and he's thinking about an idea in Torah, the question is he permitted to do so, or does he have to make the blessing? So the answer is no, he's permitted to think in Torah. However, if he should want to speak in Torah or even write Torah, then he would have to make the blessing. Now, what is the reason for that? We have to analyze that first in order to understand this case over here. This is a case where you cannot understand the Mishnah just from its own, from this one Mishnah. Because the Mishnah, by the way, was not written didactically. This was never written to teach a person how to study. This was written by Rabbi Judah the Prince, and when he wrote one Mishnah, he knew all of them very well, and so did his disciples. So it's not written didactically. In other words, it's not written as a course. You can't start with the first Mishnah, and it's going to be a course, a developmental course in the oral law. It's not going to work that way, because what they wrote down was written for scholars. And when they wrote one, they knew all the Mishnahs by heart and in depth. So when we read this Mishnah, you have to have all the knowledge at your disposal. So now we're going to this other area again. And what's the reason? Why is it that if I wake up in the morning and I'm just thinking about Torah, I don't have to recite a blessing, whereas if I am going to speak in Torah or write Torah down, I must recite a blessing? And the answer is that based upon a principle of the way Torah views the human mind. Torah views the human mind as thinking is really the beginning of a process. Verbalization is the conclusion of that process. In Torah, we say one of the 48 ways that the person gains knowledge of Torah is through lengthy speech, which means to speak it out. When you speak something out, you bring it to its final conclusion. Speaking isn't just speaking. Speaking and thinking go hand in hand. They're complementary in Torah. And that's why Rabbi Soloveitchik used to say his grandfather was very long-winded, and so was Rabbi Soloveitchik, by the way. Very long-winded. He'd go over a point again and again, from this angle, from that angle. He'd speak sometimes for an hour on one point. Why? Because in the process of speaking, you're finalizing, you're formulating your ideas. Speaking and thinking. Thinking and speaking are one unit. It begins with thinking, but it culminates. It ends. It reaches its final form in the process of speech. So speech, according to Torah, is the final formulation of your ideas. It represents the perfection of your thought. So that's why we say that the only time you must say the blessing before is if you're going to study Torah in its final, ultimate form, which means through speech. Speech means clarification. If you don't speak, you're just thinking. It's very nice, but you really haven't given it the full test until you speak it out. And I would just say this.
Rabbi?
Yes?
That's 30 minutes.
Okay. What should I do? Should I keep on going or should I...
Well, this is what we talked about the other day. That's what you're going to have to make the call.
I'll tell you. What do you think?
All right. Well, let's take
it. This week I had to give a lot of introductions. Okay, so the point that we're making is that speech is not just an isolated phenomena, but it's a continuation of the thought process and brings the thought process to its final culmination. That's the way Torah looks at speech. And Torah believes that in order to perfect your ideas, you must speak them out clearly. As a matter of fact, Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, that's Rabbi Soloveitchik's grandfather, was the greatest scholar in his day. He used to say that not only must you be able to speak it out clearly, but an idea has to be so clear that even a 10-year-old should be able to understand it. He says, if you can't explain it to a child, if you haven't got it that refined and that clear, then there's something missing in your own understanding. So explanation and clarification in Torah thought is part of good thinking. If a person can explain something, but his explanation is vague, it's not clear, then we don't say that we can't understand it so well. We say he doesn't understand it so well either. We demand very precise, clear formulation. So that's why we say that the blessing that must be recited before studying Torah, must only be recited before the full-fledged commandment of Torah, which is thinking and speaking, and or writing. And in writing also, one clarifies one's thoughts. When you write a thought down, that's equivalent to speaking. So in those two cases, you have to make the blessing before. But if you're just going to think in your mind alone, then you do not have to recite the blessing because you are not performing the complete mitzvah. Okay. Now, that's the same idea over here. That even though the blasphemer heard the name of God, and he blasphemed, but the fact is, he didn't enunciate it himself, which means that he hasn't committed the full-fledged action of blasphemy. So he is not culpable. We cannot give him the death penalty because he has not really performed it completely. That same concept, which we find from Torah, we find over here as well, with one difference. The difference is that by Torah, if you write it down, then it's considered completed. But by blasphemy, even if the person would write it down, it still would not constitute a full-fledged act of blasphemy. Over here, blasphemy differs from Torah, and for an important reason. You see, in Torah, the idea is, the concept is to clarify your thoughts. And clarification of thought can take place through writing as well as through speaking. Because when you write, you formulate clearly. You have to write down clearly what you're saying, assuming that you're a person that understands how to write clearly. So therefore, you've reached the culmination. But blasphemy is not really a clarification of abstract thought. Blasphemy is a thought process, but it's an emotional kind of thought process. Because the person over here is speaking against the Creator. Now, when he's speaking against the Creator, it's an emotional and mental phenomena. And that's why the only way that it reaches its full form is through verbalization. If he doesn't verbalize it, he has not really reached the full form of the blasphemy. And the Torah does not give the penalty to a person unless he really fully expresses this type of a thing, which means that he's a full-fledged blasphemer. You have to know when God punishes the person. We're not saying that this person is righteous if he doesn't express it fully, and even or if he uses somebody else's expression of the name of God, but he still is not culpable. We have to know when did God say that the man should be put to death, as is found in the case of Leviticus 24, I believe it. Leviticus 24 is the case in point. In Leviticus 24, it mentions. The incident is mentioned where the story. There's a story there where it came before Moses, and let's take a look for a moment because this is based on a text in the Bible actually. Am I right? Is that Leviticus? Am I wrong? Second. No, I'm wrong. Hold on a second. Numbers. Just give me 1 minute. No, hold on. And hold on 1 minute. It's, yes, Leviticus 24. Why does my, okay. Yes, here it is. Leviticus 24:10, okay? And the son of a do you have a Bible there? I hope you have a Bible there. And the son of a Israelite woman, whose father was a Mitzri, was an Egyptian man, went out among the children of Israel, and this son of the Israelite woman and a man of Israel strove together in the camp. And the Israelite woman's son blasphemed the name of the Lord and cursed. And they brought him to Moses. Okay, then it states what his mother's name was, and it says, and they put him in custody that the mind of the Lord might be shown them. In other words, that Moses is going to approach God to find out what to do in that case. Okay, that's the case in the Bible, and then the Bible says that God told Moses, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Bring forth him that has cursed outside the camp, and let all that heard him lay their hands upon his head, and let all the congregation stone him." Now, stoning is one of the four types of death that the Sanhedrin implements. Okay. Now, an important verse coming up is going to be verse 16. All right. So we'll get back to that. But this is an incident openly mentioned in the Bible itself. So here you see that a person that blasphemes is subject to the death penalty. Now, a couple of points on this. I know Talmud is not philosophy. Talmud is really the structure of the law, like we see here. But I want to give you just some basic way, rudimentary way of understanding this from a philosophical standpoint as well. The blasphemer has to enunciate the name himself, as we mentioned, and he has to.
Rabbi,
yes?
Identify the stranger. The question is, who is the stranger in verse 16?
Okay, the stranger is the. We're going to get to that in the Talmud when we get to it.
Okay.
But the stranger means the. Stranger in this case means the proselyte. Okay, we'll see that the Ben Noach is the Ben Noach is included in this, but the Ben Noach is not as the penalty is not as strict. We'll see when we get a little further, but but he's also included in the prohibition without a doubt, as you well know. I just would like to explain. I feel at this point I'm going to give you a little bit of philosophical understanding of what happened. Because there's one question that everyone should ask, and that is, why did Moses say he's going to go to God and find out about this man? I mean, if Moses had not received any law about it, so we have a principle. How do we work the law? I mean, let's say, for instance, today, you have all these responsa from Rabbi Feinstein and all these scholars. They keep on writing responsa every time something new comes up. Why? Because we have a very simple principle. If it's not prohibited, it's permitted. So all you have to do is look at God's system and see. If there's no prohibition, then it's permitted. If you have a new invention, some new kind of phenomenon we never had in the time of the Talmud. So all we do is very simple, that you look at the new phenomena and you see, does it come under any of the things that are in the Torah? It might not. Electricity, for instance. Electricity, there is one opinion that maintains electricity comes under one of the 39 categories of work. And, of course, you're completing a circuit. So there's one opinion that it comes under building, because you're completing a circuit. Rabbi Soloveitchik was not of that opinion, and Rabbi Feinstein was not of that opinion. But I'm mentioning it to show you that that's the way halacha works. See, halacha keeps on growing as new phenomena emerge, because it raises new questions, and then we have to go back to the system and see, does it come under the system or not? So we have a simple principle. If it's not prohibited, it's permissible. And Moses should have done, it would seem, the same thing. God never told Moses that if somebody blasphemes that he should be put to death. But yet Moses over here, it seems, had a question. He didn't know. So what was the question? And it states clearly that he had no idea. And God had to reveal to him the fact that this person should be put to death. So I'll give you my answer. My answer is a philosophical one. And then I'll give you the Tosafist answer, which is a halachic one. And you'll see the difference. In the meantime, you're getting a good amount of halacha as opposed to philosophy also. That's good, too. You'll see the difference between the two. My answer is as follows. My answer is that, you see, when a person blasphemes, basically, the idea of blasphemy indicates clearly that he does not really have any kind of real perception of God, because the idea is absurd. Okay, the idea is really crazy. It shows you that he relates to God on an infantile level, and he's angry, and that's why... That was the story, by the way. The story was that this man, if you look carefully, it says this man was the son of a Jewess, and his father was an Egyptian. Now, the Talmud explains that what happened was that he wanted to have a... he wanted to place his tent in among... If you remember, in the desert, they all went according to their tribes. So he wanted to place his tent among the tribe of Dan. And what happened was that they told him that he doesn't belong to that tribe, because the tribes go according to the paternal, not the maternal. So therefore, they said that he really doesn't belong there. When they come to the land of Israel, he's not going to receive a part in the land. So he got really angry, and he cursed. Okay? That was the incident. So a person that does that, it shows that they have an infantile idea of God. And because the idea of Josie should destroy Josie is nonsensical. I mean, it's nonsensical. God exists, and nothing can interfere with his existence. He is the only real existence. So the idea of blasphemy, the idea of the curse, is nonsensical, really, from a philosophical standpoint. So it shows you, A, the person does not have a real philosophical understanding, any kind of real level of understanding of God. That's A. B, it shows you that the person, whatever understanding of God he has, he is relating to that idea in a negative emotional fashion. He's angry at God. And because he's angry at God, so he's cursing. You see? So it shows you that A, he doesn't have a real deep intellectual understanding of God of any kind, not a mature understanding of God, and his childish understanding of God is fraught with negative emotions. So, a person, that's why the Torah says that a person who does that must be put to death, because the concept of Torah is that a human life is worthwhile insofar as he exists within the framework that God has created. In other words, that he has a proper idea, proper notion of the Creator, and his life is of value, because his life revolves around the proper idea of God. But even if his idea of God is infantile, we still say, you don't kill a person because the idea of God is infantile. We all were children. We all grow up. So it's a process. There's no penalty for that. But if the infantile idea of God is a negative one, so then he has no way of relating to God whatsoever, because even on an emotional level, he has a very bad idea. His emotions are tied to a detrimental concept. Then the Torah says that his whole existence is worthless. If that's his feelings, that's his notions are of such a nature, then his existence is equivalent to his non-existence, which means he basically doesn't deserve to exist. Now, that's why when Moses heard the man make that statement, he realized that such a person has no place in God's existence, because he has no relationship to God whatever, not on an emotional, and certainly not on any kind of mature intellectual level. So that's why Moses knew that his existence is worthless, but he hadn't received any law about whether he should actually kill him. So that's why he had to go and approach God. That is my explanation. It is a philosophical one. Now, I'll give you the Tosafist. The Tosafist explanation is that Moses already knew that if a person curses his father or his mother, he's to be put to death. That was already given to him before in Exodus. Okay? So Moses knew that law already. Now, the whole idea, why is it that if a person, you're not allowed to curse any human being. That's why I told my students that you should get God damn it out of your vocabulary. People will say, well, God damn it. Now, there's nothing wrong, there's nothing really wrong with saying God damn it, except the fact that it's an immature expression and a distortion of reality on a certain level. But if a person gets in the habit of saying that, he is liable to say, he's liable to say to another individual, God damn you, or God damn him. If he does that, then he's in violation of cursing a human being. And And even if you don't have to use the ineffable name of God in order to curse a human being, any name that's a reference to God, and G-O-D is a reference to God, even though it's English, because English names are considered references. So any reference to God, if you use that reference to curse another human being, is a violation of the Torah, where it says in Leviticus you shouldn't curse a deaf man. Now, it doesn't mean you shouldn't curse a deaf man. You may have read that in the Bible. It's not that cursing a deaf man is any worse than cursing a person who is capable of hearing. What it means is that even a deaf man, it means even a person that can't hear you curse, you're not permitted to curse. Certainly you're not permitted to curse a person if he hears you, where you're going to obviously irritate him. So you're not permitted to curse any human being. That's why I tell my students that you should get that, the goddamn it form a person should remove from his vocabulary, because inevitably he's going to come to use it against the person when he gets really angry. So he would be in violation. But the violation of cursing another human being is only what we call a negative, one of the negative laws. And it's not one in which one suffers the death penalty. But if a person should curse their father or their mother, then they're liable to the death penalty. That's considered very extremely serious. I want you to understand in general that when I say the death penalty is not given out so easily. There are many, many complications, and I'll just tell you one so you'll understand what it means. Before a person does anything where there is a death penalty, he must be warned by two witnesses before he does it. If a person is about to murder somebody, so two witnesses must say to him, we are telling you that this is a violation of the Torah, violation of God's law, and you're violating such and such a law, and if you do this, you are going to be sentenced to death by the Sanhedrin. And then the person must respond and must say, I don't care. Even so, I'm going to do it. It's an amazing law. If he doesn't say that, then he's not culpable. Okay? It's very hard to give a death penalty. So the essential thing to remember, when the Torah says death penalty, it means that it's not that the death penalty was given so freely. It's very hard to give it. But it means to say that the violation is so serious, the person really deserves death. But to actually get death in a court is not an easy matter. It's difficult. So if the person just keeps quiet and just kills somebody, he can't get the death penalty. The Sanhedrin has to, there's another elastic clause the Sanhedrin has to employ sometimes if you have a community, a society which is really reckless and they try to avoid, they do things which are really horrible, but they just avoid making themselves culpable for the death penalty. So then the Sanhedrin has an elastic clause where they can implement certain of their own laws. And they can give the death penalty if they see fit, in order to, that society is becoming lawless, then they have a right to intervene. But this is a separate area. I just want you to know, whenever we say death penalty, it's not so simple. But at any rate, it certainly means that it is a major violation. Even if the Sanhedrin does not kill this person, it means that that in God's eyes, he's deserving of death, which is really the important thing. It means that this type of an action, even though he doesn't say to these witnesses, well, I'm going to blaspheme in spite of what you say, and he just blasphemes privately in his home or whatever, it means he has violated a major thing, and according to, in God's eyes, he's not the servant of life anymore. So that's the important thing to keep in mind. Getting back to the point that we were discussing, so the Tosafists say that Moses asked the question because he had a very simple thing. And he knew already that you're not allowed to curse father or mother. Now, the respect for father and mother is not because father and mother themselves deserve respect. It's different. See, and this is something I think that was printed in the Gap, but maybe I should elaborate a bit on this right now. That, for instance, let's say a father and a mother put a child out on the doorstep, and someone else picks up that child and raises that child. Now, who is the father or mother that the Torah says that you must respect your father and mother? Is it the ones that raised him lovingly and cared for him, or is it the biological parents? And the answer is it's the biological parents. Okay? So respect, honor for father and mother does not have anything to do with the fact that the father and mother were good to the child. It has nothing to do with it. Because The fact that that they had sex to have the child could be they did it for their own lust. They didn't necessarily do it for the child. The child wasn't even in existence then. And taking care of the child, they may not have taken care of the child. They may have abused the child. But there's a separate thing. I'll get to that in a moment. But the point I'm making is that the child, even if the parents abandon the child, somebody else has the child. The parents who are the real parents are the ones who are the biological parents. The reason is this: respect for father and mother is based upon the idea that they reflect God, because God, the Creator, is the cause of all of our existence. Now, father and mother are the immediate cause, so to speak, but the ultimate cause is God. So when you see father and mother, what you're seeing is a reflection of the Creator. Of course, they were the immediate cause of your existence. That reminds you of the ultimate cause of your existence, which is God. So respecting father and mother is really a fulfillment, a method, a process of respecting. It's a component of respecting God. That's why. And that's why the Torah says if your parents tell you to go against God, then of course there's no respect, because the whole idea of respecting your parents is because they reflect God. But if they tell you to go against God, then it's crazy, because there's no respect for they themselves per se. And if they're evil people, so again, there's no law of respecting them. Because they don't represent God in that way, if they're evil, if they're idolaters or whatever. So the basic idea is that respect for father and mother is a reflection of the Creator. So Moses knew this. Now, since Moses knew this, the Tosafists say, so he would have known that if a person curses father and mother, who are merely their respect is based upon the fact that they reflect the Creator, because they're an immediate cause, and they reflect the idea of the ultimate cause of God, so certainly if the person does that to God himself, then certainly he should be he should suffer the death penalty. So that's why Moses knew that there's got to be a death penalty. That's what the Tosafists say. However, if you're following along right now, so then you'll say, so why did Moses have to go to God? We know in the Torah that Moses had to work out many things in his mind when he worked it out. You see the argument between Aaron and Moses about eating the sin offering. So they worked it out logically, just like Torah scholars work things out logically. Whatever Moses understood and worked out, he didn't have to ask God if he knew that it's so. So what was his dilemma over here? Why did he have to ask God? It would seem that the Tosafists are right. If cursing father and mother causes one to deserve the death penalty and makes his existence worthless, certainly, insofar as if he does that to God, it will be much, much worse. So the answer is over here, there is a principle that we have in the Sanhedrin. And that principle is that sometimes a person, whenever the Sanhedrin gives a punishment, the punishment is for two purposes. One is to remove the individual from the society, that's number one. But also a punishment is to benefit the person. The punishment fits the crime. And the person before he suffers a death penalty, he repents, and it's considered that the penalty that the Torah gives him is a forgiveness. It gives him forgiveness for his crime as well. The penalty has to fit the crime. So the Tosafists say over here Moses didn't know whether a penalty would be enough for this man, whether he even could. See, the penalty has a benefit, because the penalty gives the man forgiveness, so that in the eternal world, he doesn't suffer. It's forgiveness for his crime. So Moses didn't know whether this penalty might be, this crime might be so serious, so severe, that God wouldn't even give a penalty, because the penalty would never really give the person forgiveness. The penalty wouldn't be big enough for the crime. That's why the Tosafists say Moses asked God what he should do in this instance. You find that concept that sometimes for instance, it says if a person kills someone accidentally, so then he has to go to the cities where he has to go to these special cities and stay there until the high priest dies. You may be familiar with that law. Now it says if he kills someone accidentally. Now if he kills them intentionally, but without witnesses, he doesn't go to those cities. Why? Because though being in that city is a forgiveness for the crime of killing accidentally. By the not forgiveness for the crime of killing intentionally. So he has no forgiveness, so he can't have the penalty. So the penalty always has to fit the crime. So the Tosfos say that's why Moses thought that this crime is so serious that perhaps there is no penalty for it. So he asked God, and God said, no, in this case, the penalty would be the most severe death, which is the death through with the Sanhedrin employed through stoning, and that's what this individual deserves. Okay? So there you have two explanations. The halachic one, which the Tosfos give, derived from the father and mother, and then the one that I gave you, the philosophical one. So you can see the difference between philosophical thinking and halachic thinking. Halachic thinking is based upon the principles of the law, and the philosophic is based upon why. What is so bad if the person blasphemes? It's why is he really to be put to death? You see, I'm giving the philosophical. But when we're studying Talmud, we really are strictly studying not the philosophical, but the halachic. And as I said, as we go on, you'll be able to see more, get more of a taste of what that halachic is like. But I think what we did tonight is a good example, and I think it would be wise if you can, you know, go over it, review it, and try to see how one draws out these principles and explains a Mishnah. That one, so far we just did one law in the Mishnah, one line basically in the Mishnah. But it's based upon principles, universal principles. Okay? I would assume that we're coming to the...
You're doing real well because you're right on time.
Okay, great.
And so we can close it out. Do you have a clock there?
I got a clock, yeah.
Well, you're doing well then. Okay. All right, we appreciate it, and I'll speak with you later. We'll not have class next week, correct?
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Okay, well,
bye-bye.
Thank you, good night.